All right, Scott, looks like we are rocking and rolling here.
Who is this and what have you done with Mike Rose?
This is supposedly the new, enhanced, better balanced Mike and Scotty live show.
Well, we're gonna get some feedback. We'll know, within a couple of hours whether this little experiment worked. But folks, welcome to the March episode of Mike and Scotty Live, and we've taken to heart your comments about our recording levels, and we're trying to make things even and copacetic, and this hopefully is a positive result to that, Mike.
We actually did, I think, three test recordings here, and I got rid of automatic levels and pushed Scott into the next room away from his microphone. And I'm going to be yelling at my microphone the whole time here. I'm very excited. I've got a lot of stuff to talk about, so hopefully this will work.
Right. And you should have heard what we talked about in those
No, you shouldn't.
recordings. We said damn and some other
We
words.
got all the cuss words out of our system
We
here.
did. We did. We're good. We're good for a while now. Now, Mike, as usual, you've always got some interesting topics to talk about in with regards to how they tie into to your model railroad. And I really like this first topic this month because it's a company that's near and dear to my heart and some folks that I've known for a long, long time, as well as you. You're using some of their products now, but the company is New England Brownstone, Mike, and they make specialized hydrocal products, bridge abutments and piers and tunnel portals and so on and so forth. And I know that they've been doing a little bit of custom work for you. I know you want to talk about that first off the bat here today.
Yeah, my first encounter with New England Brownstone products was actually on Jim Dufour's layout, I think. And he had some really nice looking stone abutments there. And I mean, this was long enough ago that I said, "Gee, where'd those come from?" And he said, "New England Brownstone." And I said, "Well, I never heard of those guys." So fast forward a little bit, it turns out Confalone was using them too. And I think my first set of them was actually a set of abutments that that Mike C didn't need anymore and let me have. And in fact, those are under Mashopin Creek's bridge right now. So as time went on, as I'm remodeling the layout and adding waterways and if you're in Pennsylvania, you literally can't have too many bridges and creeks that the track is crossing because they're basically everywhere. As time went on, I kind of went away from the stock, Walthers and Chooch and what have you, and started going more with a higher quality type of a product. And it wasn't too long after that, probably at the Craftsman Structure Show that I was a part of one year. Russ Green did a really good clinic on how he creates his masters, and the reason they look so good is that it's basically hand carved stone, and he knows how to do it. So he does a great job with the master. As it turns out, in his day job, he does super high quality plaster casting for dental work, which obviously has to be really just right. So the fact that he's a good modeler and the fact that he's got the ability to make these masters in a very realistic way, combined with his technical prowess from his daily work with plaster casting, what you get out of his company, I think, is second to none and pretty much unique, I think, in the hobby. So there have been times, you had mentioned some custom stuff. There have been times where I've worked with Russ to come up with something. However, once in a while, you kind of luck out, and as it turns out, on the podcast group, I think I posted a few teaser pictures of the latest round of castings I got from Russ, and I had sent Russ some pictures of Tuscarora Creek, which is in Skinner's Eddy, and it's the last major scenic element to that whole aisle that I'm remodeling there that you saw on your last visit down. And I think I even mentioned at the time that I was waiting for the abutments as kind of the next step in finishing all of that off. When I sent the pictures and the inquiry over to Russ, he told me that he had actually been working on something right along those lines, and he liked the pictures that I sent him because they really had some personality, these abutments, if you can think of an abutment having personality, but these did. They were aesthetically pretty cool because it looked like what Lehigh Valley had done was take a single track cut stone abutment and then poured concrete on either side of it and on top of it to kind of raise it up a little bit. I know Russ has got some other castings like that in his line, but this was a little different because I needed a pier done the same way and these abutments. So to make a long story short, he said, I'm in the final stages of working on some masters for this, so let me finish that up and get a set out to you, and you can tell me what you think. And no surprise, they came in and they were just the bee's knees. They were wonderful, and I didn't waste any time getting right on top of them, and very shortly had them colored with pan pastels as the first pass on doing it, and put them in place, and geez, they just looked great. That's the only way you can say it. And those and that and I snapped a couple of quick pictures, and that's what I put on the podcast group. But Russ did want me to mention that you can buy them, you can have these. They're either about to be or already available on his website.
Isn't it fantastic when a product exceeds your expectations?
It happens so seldom,
It really does.
but with maybe it's too high expectation, I don't know, but with Russ's stuff, it always happens.
Well, and so, I've known him for several years, and I've known him, I think, since he started in the business, and he's done over the years, as far as my kits go, he's done quite a bit of work for me. He did all of the masters for the flooring for my roundhouse kit.
Oh, wow.
He did the masters for the walls for the boiler house that went with that roundhouse kit, as well as the floor and loading dock area for the little supply house that went with that kit. And then he did the loading docks for me for the kit after that, Alaski cabinet,
So it
as
sounds like
well
you've got a
as.
pretty good history with him as well.
Well, and so, Russ is the kind of guy where, you give him a sketch and, give him the dimensions and you can't wait to see what he comes back with, because it's going to be fantastic.
Right.
And I remember seeing this stuff for the first time, and I was a little bit on the edge of my seat with my first kit, because a lot of time, effort, and resources went into it. And to see what he brought back was just phenomenal. And I don't remember what he charged me, but I remember thinking that I had taken incredible advantage of him. And I remember trying to pay him more, and he was just good with it. I can't, and that's the custom work. But his stuff that's in stock is equally amazing. It's nebrownstone.com for anybody who has not been to that website or is not a customer. I think I speak for Mike when I say we highly recommend Russ. And the other thing too is, and it's a delight to be able to say that he and his wife Tina are two of the nicest people you will meet in
Oh
this hobby.
yeah, I was just about to comment on that. I mean, that's like the frosting on the cake. Just super nice guy, and Tina's great, and yeah, exactly. It's just all good.
So I'll be interested to see more pictures. I know you've posted some to the Facebook page, and you're always keeping up with that, which we appreciate too, Mike. So.
Yeah, I like to include everybody on that. But probably the next round of pictures will be, I guess, the next thing I'm going to be doing as soon as time permits, meaning in the next 4 or 5 days, I would think, would be to complete the stream bed. You know, I need to mix up some colored Sculpta mold and get that in place. And actually, this is something I can pick your brain about a little bit too. The next couple of streams that I do will be different in terms of the coloring of the stream bed. I don't want to just do my usual, you know, black paint under it and make it look deep. I want it to have a little bit of a, you know, a color characteristic to it. And I just thought I'd pick your brain a little bit because some people like to tint the Envirotech. Some people do it with making sure that the bottom is the color they want to indicate there. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've done it both ways, and my caution with tinting the Envirotex is that you can over tint.
I also don't want to mess with the chemistry of it. You know that I'm a little nervous about that.
Well, I don't. I mean, I suppose at some point you would. I've never had that problem,
Really? Okay. So it's a little
and
more forgiving than you might think.
You know, I think as long as you've got that hardener to resin ratio correct, and Lord knows I have screwed that up on occasion. Have I apologized thoroughly for that yet, Mike?
You have.
Okay, good.
I mean, it
We can move.
wouldn't hurt to do it again, but you know.
I'm so incredibly sorry. You know, ideally, I think it looks better if you tint the Envirotex. I think that requires a little bit of experimentation, though. Again, you've got to make sure that that ratio is correct so that it's not too dark.
I think part of my problem is that, among other things, I'm not entirely sure exactly what color I want it to look like. With one exception, there's an upcoming project where I'm going to be doing the Lackawanna River at Pittston Junction, and that river is basically orange. And I know you're thinking orange. Yeah, it's orange. It looks like a river of rust.
Well, Central Pennsylvania, I can completely believe that.
Well, you remember the stories about the Great Mine disaster, and
Sure.
I guess it was late 50s, I think all of that happened, that basically shut down the entire anthracite industry in that whole valley, because the mines were all interconnected, and the river, I guess, flooded all the mines. Well, there's some stories about that they told me the last time I was down in Pittston. I guess there was a hole in the bottom of the river that they actually tried to plug up by shoving old freight cars into it, believe it or not. And when the river is low enough, like in dead summer, if you know where to look, you can actually see the remnants of the cars still sticking out of the bottom of the river. Amazing, if you ask me. I hope to see that someday, because that's not something you see every day.
You have to wonder what the intelligence level of some of these decision makers were.
I think it was more desperation.
About, well, not that the ecology, you know, was ever a consideration. But, you know, talk about unsound practices.
Right.
Yeah.
So the reason the Lackawanna River is orange is that the underground mines are literally just leaking into it on a continuous basis, and whatever minerals are there in that mine are just constantly leaching into the river. So every time I've seen this river, it looks like you took a bottle of Rustall and shook it up, and I mean that's basically what it looks like, you know. So I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, well, why don't you just tint the Envirotex there with Rustall? I might.
I would not use an alcohol based.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, maybe.
You really need a solvent based paint, believe it or not. So that's one thing. The other thing that just crosses my mind while you're describing this is that, you know, we as prototype modelers, we see something and we believe it because it's based on the prototype and we can look at it with our own two eyes. But sometimes it's difficult to convey that belief to others. So, you know, you may have an orange river that exists in reality. Everybody that sees your layout may look at that and just it be hard pressed to suspend disbelief. So just, you might want to just keep that in the back of your mind, even though it exists, it may just be so funky that it may not work.
So, a more of a subtle treatment of it as opposed to making it orange.
Well, and then, in the same vein, no pun intended, that we never want to do anything that draws so much attention away from everything else.
Yeah.
So, I try to err on the side of subtlety.
Okay, that's interesting. You're
Something to think
well, no,
about.
you're not the first person to suggest just that sentiment to me. So maybe I need to give that a little bit more thought. On these other rivers that, getting back to the subject at hand, the one at Skinner's Eddy there is a perfect example, and also the one between Ransom and Tunkhannock. Both of those are sort of, I don't know, a little on the cloudy side, maybe. In other words, that's and I haven't done that yet. You know how I've done most of my waterways so far. So I guess I should just experiment a little bit. But you're thinking you said solvent paint, not latex, right?
Correct.
Okay, that's easier
Correct.
actually because I've got a pretty good like Floquil or something like that.
Floqual works just fine.
Okay, I've got plenty of that around stashed away.
Yeah, and I'd do, maybe three or four, little squares. Just pour them, tint them a little differently, and let them dry, and then decide based on those if one of those is okay, or if you can move on based on one of those.
Yeah, and in your experience, is it hard to judge it until it's cured?
No, you can judge it wet.
Okay.
It's going to, nothing is going to change.
All right. Well, I'll be doing that sooner than later because once I get the stream bed in place, really, at that point, I want to be able to pour those two creeks that I just talked about, and then because you can mix that stuff up in batches, and it's probably just as easy to do two creeks at once rather than just a single one. By the time you get set up with all your cups and all of that stuff,
Oh,
so
yeah.
I think I'm going to try that. So maybe I'll do a little bit of experimenting and see what we think. Don't be surprised if I send you a picture for an opinion.
Well, and I would just, obviously, and I'm preaching to the choir, but maybe some of our listeners may not think of this, that when you're doing something like that, you've got to be very, very diligent about writing down the formulas that you're using. And then realize too that, once you hit upon that ratio, that you need to amortize that out based on, the entire river, lake, or stream that you're going to pour.
Yeah, fortunately, in the case of both of these, we're not talking about a large quantity, like not a long length of these streams. They're probably each, let me see, maybe 14 inches or so long, you know what I mean? So I'm and not that wide because again, I'm modeling high summer, you know what I mean? So these creeks are at their low point. I don't need a large volume of material. It's going to be like the exact opposite of the Mahoopany pour we did. I don't know how many trips we made down at EC Moore to get more material, but
Well, I know you cleaned them out, and
yeah,
that stuff's not cheap.
no, it's not. That is one expensive river.
But short of the area that didn't fully cure, I'm sorry.
It came out largely okay. I still wonder sometime if there's anything I can do to rescue that one area that I don't know, you saw it, it basically has everything in the world stuck to it. So I don't know if like a thin coat of future or something like that might rescue it or not. It hasn't been my on the front burner in terms of things to try
Yeah,
to
I mean,
do.
it's possible that you can encapsulate it. And I would I you might be onto something. Maybe using a dissimilar medium would be the trick to it.
Yeah, I did try gloss medium and wasn't happy with the result, and it didn't really stick to it either.
Yeah, I can understand that. All right, so this will make for a great report next month.
Oh yeah, it's got to be done by next month because I've got a column deadline. So I figure I have to wrap this up in 2 weeks and write it up and get it into Model Railroad Hobbyists. So it's sometimes it's amazing what an article deadline will do for you in terms of your productivity.
Yep, no, without question. I know we've got a few more topics to discuss with regards to your layout. I'm going to skip around here a little bit because we're kind of on a craftsman theme, if you will, with the stuff from New England Brownstone. And so I want to kind of talk about this. I mentioned last month that I was building a lighthouse for the folks at Stephen Lamb Associates. They're custom model railroad builders, and he's working on a project layout. It's a Gull, I believe it's called Gulliver's Point, for an organization down in New York City. But I finished to the degree that I could, Mike. I finished the lighthouse.
That sounds interesting.
No, it's just it's kind of just symptomatic of the some of the problems you run into with the different qualities of kit manufacturers. And the bottom line is I couldn't finish the structure, and it had nothing to do with the present owner of the design of the kit, which is Best. Brian and Jill Bollinger, who own Best Trains, bought this design and this kit from a gentleman, Bruce Sparrow, who passed away a number of years ago, and the engineering of the kit was just awful. And in fact, there were just a couple of areas that were critical that were so wrong that I couldn't finish up. The first were the windows, and the trend became, as a cost-cutting measure to a degree, to laser cut the windows and put them on double-sided sticky tape, which is, to me, it's just an expediency that I wouldn't ever take. First of all, companies like Grantline and Tichy have too many offerings that you can take advantage of, and windows aren't really all that expensive.
No, they're downright cheap, aren't they?
They really are. They
Especially the
look
Tichy
great.
stuff.
Their tolerances are perfect. You're never gonna have, you can go on their website and take a look at the measurements for the openings, draw them into your CAD program, cut them on your laser, and the windows are gonna fit perfect every time. But that isn't always the case with when you're laser cutting two separate materials, because there is a margin of error, and you don't want to have that margin of error both in the piece that the window is going in and then in the window itself,
Sure, it just magnifies it.
because you're asking for trouble. So the windows didn't really fit all that great. He didn't provide them with a CAD drawing that captured all of the windows that they needed. So we had to go back and forth a couple of times with missing windows and missing acetate. And it was just, when you're building something on a timeline for someone who's paying you for the privilege, you want to be able to get that thing done, get it to them so that they can do what they need to do. And I was unable to do that. But the most critical piece to this was the glass enclosure for the light itself, which was a scored 10-sided piece of clear plastic.
Okay.
It didn't fit.
So it was scored and partially bent?
Well, it was scored, and then you had to bend it around this decagon that sat at the base of the top of the lighthouse
Okay.
and glue it in place. Which, in and of itself, if you ever try to glue clear plastic to itself, you really need to be, well, you need to be a better modeler than I am. to not make a mess. But the problem was that when you wrapped it around Mike, the two ends didn't meet. There was about a 16th of an inch gap.
You put that towards the back.
Well, you know what? If it were, well, I wouldn't do that for anybody, but you know, I suppose in some cases it might not matter, but for this particular client, I certainly would never do that.
You realize that was a joke, right?
No, I know, but it was so disheartening. You know, I was struggling to get this thing done, and
So I'm trying to understand, when you say you couldn't finish it, does that mean you didn't finish it,
I didn't
or?
finish it. The deadline had come. I had to deliver it. I explained to Stephen what the issue was. Jill Bollinger, who is responsible for the production of the kits, was very, very cooperative and helpful. We had, you know, several long conversations about what needed to be done to correct the issues, and you know, she was going to redraw and recut those pieces, both the windows and this glass enclosure, but she was going to have to send it to right to Stephen Lamb, and you know, they were going to have to fix it, because unfortunately that layout had to be, the buildings had to be put in place, the scenery had to be done around it, and the layout had to be shipped out. In fact, I believe it's gone now. So
So basically, you delivered a like a mostly finished thing that,
yeah, it was
yeah.
pr probably about, you know, 2 or 3 hours with, you know, from being completed.
Kind of
But
unsatisfying, isn't it?
oh, it was a complete letdown for me. I never ever want to do that to a client, but I, you know, I just felt so completely handcuffed.
Yep. Let me ask you this. I mean, I realize it was a lighthouse, which is not something that, you've probably never scratch built one, but I mean, in retrospect, would it have been easier to scratch build it?
I kind of felt like I was a little bit. It would have taken longer. You know, the I was actually somewhat encouraged by the engineering of that geometry. So, you know, you've got a taper, and you've got a cylinder, a tapered cylinder.
It's kind of like the same issue if you were scratch building a smokestack, it's,
So in that regard, Bruce did a nice job, but it just kind of fell apart, you know, at the end, at the top.
Really makes you appreciate when a kit is very well designed and engineered, and you don't run into that. It really makes you appreciate it.
Well, the engineering is really so critical, and it's the thing that either is going to keep Craftsman Structure building alive or not. And you know, I'll point to, and I know I talked a little bit about this last time, companies like South River Model Works and Bob Van Gelder. And Bob completely understood the fact that people who didn't have his artistic ability were going to be buying and building these kits. And in order for him to stay in business, he had to engineer them so that everybody who bought one could build one. And he did just that. You know, George Selios at Fine Scale Miniatures did the same exact thing. George and Bob are two complete artists. They could build anything from anything. But they knew that the people that were buying the kits weren't.
Right. That's why they're buying
So,
a kit.
yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, and guys like Doug Fiscali, at Foscale Limited, the exact same thing. There's so much thought put into the engineering of his kits that, as Bob Van Gelder calls it, an educated beginner, a motivated beginner, can buy one and build it. Sierra West is another example.
And
And
enjoy it. That's the key.
And enjoy it, right? Because if you're, even if you have the ability to build something, but it's a miserable experience, you're not likely to fork over, the money to do it again.
Right. I mean, if you obviously there's a big, I mean, the same thing applies to, let's say, freight cars, right? And even though you have Tangent cranking out absolutely wonderful freight cars on a fairly regular basis, Moloco's another example, right? When Tangent came out with the X58, and I had a little bit of advance warning on it, but it's not like I dumped the rail yard model kits that I had. I consider those little treasures, and even though I bought plenty of the Tangent ready-to-run cars because I want some X58s now, I'm going to build every one of the rail yard models kits that I have in stock just for the pure joy of building a wonderful kit like that. As long as my eyesight holds out.
I've built so many good ones, and I've built so many really stinkers, that it just, and I, as someone who has been a kit manufacturer, I try to put myself in the shoes of someone who's buying and building the kit. And I've had a couple of really, really bad experiences with kits that just you can't build.
But you can also empathize, I think, with the kit manufacturer because nobody sets out to produce a lousy kit.
No, but I also think that that in some cases they purposely don't pay attention to the details. I've had kit manufacturers tell me to my face that they didn't feel the instructions were important because people should be able to put these together.
Really?
And those instructions are, I can't even emphasize enough how critical they are.
Well, I'll go back to Railyard as an example of that. Now, his kits are not trivial, and in one of them, the sulfuric acid tank car, I worked very closely with Gene Fusco to develop the instructions for that. So that kit has a ton of what I call brass origami. It's part of what makes the resulting model so stupendous because he basically just reproduced everything you see under a tank car, and because it's a tank car, you see everything, right? So that was the whole driving force behind him doing that. But it also means that the instructions need to be very good, and I built that kit with nothing but a very first pass kind of very rough set of instructions and about 58 emails and a dozen phone calls back and forth to Gene. But I think the resulting instructions, having somebody who didn't know what Gene knew try to build the thing and the questions that I had for him, he incorporated all of that into the instructions, which resulted in instructions that answer pretty much every conceivable question you'd have about how to build the kit, to the point where I think it was at that point where he started enclosing a little mini CD with the kit, and there were just gobs of prototype photos and work in process photos. Some of them were mine, some of them were his. And basically, everything you need to understand, if you just delve into those instructions, the information is there.
It's a make or break thing. It really is. And it's the difference between, and it doesn't matter what the craftsman kit is, a freight car or a structure. Ones that are done right are a joy to build,
Right.
and the ones that aren't are a little piece of hell on earth.
Well, the thing that was remarkable about Gene's kits is that they just went together perfectly in a way that people building that were accustomed to building resin kits in the past, it was just unprecedented. Nobody had ever seen a resin. It was basically like building a styrene kit, except that you didn't use liquid cement. You used,
Sure.
I used Cypox, but a lot of people use CA to do it. But it was
Sure.
everything went together perfectly. Everything fit perfectly. Nothing was shrunken. You know what I mean? It was just amazing. And I think that now that his kits are no longer available, some people know that Gene went on to Intermountain and is beginning to do some good work for them as part of the product development team there. And the H54 and the 138H hoppers that'll be coming out are purely based on his covered hopper kits that he once offered. So I'm ordering them sight unseen because I know if he's involved in that project, they're going to be right, So I think that's going to be another one of those very desirable ready-to-run models that will eventually come out. Might be a year or more before we see them, but they're probably worth the wait.
Now, I'm sure your memories go back as far as mine as in terms of resin freight car kits, but I clearly remember the brittle resin that would shrink and crack and break if you weren't careful, and
Right.
the likelihood of building anything successfully was not really high.
Things that would be warped in the
Oh,
box,
just
yeah.
awful.
I think in many ways what Gene did was he made some, I don't know, I think he took advantage of some advances in materials available. But also, I think his special gift was in perfecting the casting techniques. And I think he had a very high yield. In speaking with him, there was not a lot that didn't come out that was just right. So all of that combined, I think, ends up with a kit that's a joy to build because things fit and it's well designed in terms of how you assemble it. I miss those kits. Those were the days where, we didn't have quite as many things available to us as we do now. And sometimes a small manufacturer doing small runs like that was the only way to get a certain prototype.
Well, I think, just like anything else that's limited in availability, you have a greater appreciation for it.
Especially in retrospect.
What's you want to talk about your the progress you're making with wiring the Pittston yard, and I'm interested. I don't love electronics, but I'm always interested when someone tells me that they're doing it in an unusual way.
Well, I think on the last podcast we talked a little bit about the hair pulling event I had with, and I'm speaking metaphorically because
I know. I was going to say, what the hell
we know
there are you
that's not
talking about?
happening in essence, but
Not really, no.
with the feeder situation on that short segment that was just giving me fits, and the quick update on that is all is fine. And all it took was for me to get my head out of my butt, basically. It was a problem with multiple errors. And I was okay in algebra. I could solve for x, but when there's y and z in the equation, it makes it a heck of a lot harder to debug. And honestly, the way I solved that problem ultimately, which is it's probably going to sound a little silly, but I made up the world's longest alligator clip lead, and I couldn't wait until train night when I would have my buddy Dave to help me. I needed to kind of get on with life, and I'm trying to debug this problem that was in the world's worst spot, and it was like up on top in a spot where you there was no way you could be at the area in question and have and be anywhere else. So, but I needed to be under the layout and with that area. If it was track on the edge of the layout, it would have been a snap. But naturally, this was in the world's worst spot. So, by taking the world's longest alligator clip lead and going in there and one by one verifying each feeder that was down below, I quickly discovered that the problem, which is no surprise, was that certain assumptions that I had made because they must be that way were simply not correct. And what I learned was when you connect enough feeders incorrectly, you can get into a situation where you don't get a dead short. And that was, I think, that was news to me. That part of it was news to me. What I found is you can, if everything else is connected properly, you connect one feeder out of phase, you immediately know it. But when there's multiple like that, not exactly. It doesn't happen in the same way. So it made it hard for me to debug. And the problem was that sometimes when you're drilling your holes for your feeder wires, you don't always drill them straight down because you're trying to work get it as close to the rail. And if they cross in the plywood, the feeder that and because it's a rewire, the color code was meaningless. So that's the key element there. So I'm concluding, looking at the feeder, well, based on where it's located, this has got to be the rear rail, but it wasn't. And that was in enough situations that it defied debug, because even when you got one of them, you had more than one of them that was wrong, and you didn't think that many of them could be like that. So that was not fun. I really enjoy model railroading and most of what I do in it. I did not have fun fixing this problem. It was non-fun. So it
Non-fun.
was non-fun, but I got beyond it, and finally came to the point where I was getting ready to build Pittston Yard, which was the whole point of this giant layout kaboom, right? It was in order to get this yard. So one of the things I was doing was, because this yard is a limited clearance kind of a thing with staging below it, I really didn't want to do the standard wire up your feeders and drop them down below and then connect them all up. It would have been a bear to try to do that with the clearances involved. And I didn't want to do anything that negatively impacted the amount of space that was available down there. So I tried to think outside the box a little bit and think, all right, well, if you're not going to run your feeders in the usual way, what's physically possible here? And I finally concluded that when I put down my cork, if I just left some alleyways, I could surface run the feeders basically on the plywood, but below the cork, and then just ballast over it. So I left a whole series of grooves, if you will, that went from front to back, and also a few cross-connecting ones. And as I started to install this yard, I'm installing the feeders, but instead of using the usual, I don't know, 6 or 7 inch wire length, I was using 18 inch length wires, and I'm running them through these alleys, and quickly concluding that if I'm crossing tracks, the thing to do was to nick the insulation and solder them to the crossing tracks, rather than have too many wires stuffed into this groove, because if you're running a feeder to every rail, it's a lot of wires.
Sure, yeah.
So it's almost like you're creating a little mini bus that you're connecting these rails to, and then when they get to the front edge of the yard, I drilled a hole, quarter inch or so in from the edge of the layout. They go straight down, and they will then be soldered to the main bus that's right under the front edge of the layout. That'll be hidden by the short fascia that I'll use there. So it was a very different wiring experience, because it forced you to really think about where these feeders are going. And when you're putting in FlexTrack, you've got some choices in terms of where you're hooking up to that FlexTrack. It doesn't have to be in the exact middle of it. So I was trying to keep in mind there might be advantages to connecting more towards one end or the other based on some other feeders that I was going to have to be hooking up on adjacent tracks. Kind of an interesting chess match there. I found it interesting in that, I've been laying tracks since I was, I don't know, 10 or 11. And this was something completely new. So you don't very often get to do that when you've laid as much track as I have over time. I enjoyed the challenge. I don't think I would want to always do it that way, naturally, and I wouldn't want to repeat it, but it was an interesting project to do.
Well, to me, as you're describing this, it dawns on me that, most of the vast majority of the folks that build layouts put their wiring in, right after the track work gets in. There's no scenery, there's no structures, there's no, no nothing, and certainly no impediments under the bench work itself.
Sure.
So you've got really a blank canvas to do it however the best way to do it. And I fully could visualize what you had to deal with, with a layout that's been with areas that have been finished several times over, and all of the things that come about as a result of that.
It's way easier to build it right the first time.
Sure. Well, if we and not that it wasn't, it's just the evolution of the hobby, correct?
Sure.
Yep.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
No, well, no, and listen, every time you decide to renovate, you're going to have that same exact issue.
Yeah, I maintain, and I'm lacking some credibility in this, but I maintain that the kind of wholesale renovations that I've done over the last couple of years, I don't think that's going to need to be done again. I'm not saying I'll never change anything, but this massive scale of this rebuilding of an entire layout in place, that's I don't have that in me again. You know what I mean? That's not going to happen. And I have the layout I always wanted now. I'm not going to need to do that again.
Well, we'll never. Let's just agree to never say never.
I'm not saying never, but the scope of the way it's been done and changed, very unlikely to need to be done like that again.
Well, and obviously, for someone who's operation focused, you want to get back to that point as quickly as possible, too.
I am so itching to run trains at this point, you can't imagine.
Yeah.
It, here it is, early March when we're recording this, and next month, towards the middle end of the month, will be the anniversary of when I started all of this layout kaboom. So although it's not etched in stone in terms of an actual deadline, it would be really, really good for morale if by the 1 year anniversary I'm running trains over the entire layout again. And I really think it's within reach.
Well, if anyone can make it happen, you can.
Well, when you think
Anybody?
about it, now just to finish the status on the yard, as of last night, train night, all of the track is down with the exception of a little area where I'm waiting for a crossing that won't come in until next month. And there's really no obstacle to using the yard. So I've got some more feeders to connect, but basically when I'm done with that, and believe me, I am checking every section of feeders with a meter as I go along. I don't want any rude surprises, you know what I mean? But I have every expectation that when these feeders are all in place and hooked up to the front bus, in two wires, I can turn the yard on and start testing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's going to be, I think, a big moment for me.
Well, and it'll be a great update when we're able to talk about it too.
We should definitely, without unless something bad happens here, the next time we record, that's what we'll be talking about.
Sure. Anybody that knows me that's listened to this podcast or its antecedent knows that I am not an electronics person. And but having said that, I've also seen some people who are worse than I am at it. And remember how simple life was when all you had to do was wire up the Atlas switch machine. Or the Atlas controller or the Atlas selector, and I still don't know exactly what they did, but I knew how to turn a screwdriver, and it was pretty simple.
Yeah, but the minute you want to run more than one train, it got pretty complicated pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was
I remember the book, The H.O. Railroad That Grows, Lynn Westcott.
Yeah,
I
sure
remember
do.
getting that book and my dad and I going through it, trying to figure out how to do this whole bus matrix toggle strip thing that, and we did it. I remember him cutting the terminal strips out of masonite on his table saw, and us actually making the terminal strips and laying in a supply of these really heavy duty, nice toggle switches that I still use, believe it or not. I mean, they've been repurposed a whole bunch of times.
Well, that's great.
But you pretty quickly realize running trains that way has nothing to do with anything prototypical. You're more focused on playing hopscotch with the toggles and staying one block ahead of your train and all of that. And I can honestly say I don't miss that pre-DCC era one iota.
Well, and so I mentioned that there are people out there that are worse than me, and many of you are familiar with a gentleman by the name of Mike Tylek, who is an incredible artist in this hobby and a pioneer in so many ways, and just an overall great modeler and just a great guy and a great friend. But I'll never forget the first time I went over to his house to see his model railroads, and I looked under the benchwork, and as a terminal strip, he had taken the aluminum lid off of a green bean can
Wait a minute. Can you
and punch.
repeat that?
Yeah, we have to play it back. And punched some holes in it, and had soldered his wires to the holes, and
That's a new one on me.
yeah. And I swear to God, that's the truth. That's how he did it, and it somehow managed to serve the purpose. But you gotta be careful not to touch it because you cut your hands on the edge.
Wow.
But yeah, so
See, this is what happens when you run out of stuff.
yeah. Now, well, I but people decry the lack of craftsmanship in the hobby now, which I would argue is not true at all. There's a case of making do, of cobbling something together, of
Yeah, that's
overcoming.
pure MacGyver. I mean, that's what that
Yeah,
is.
well, it's amazing what you can do, what you can overcome when you put your mind to it. Speaking of overcoming, you had Craig Biskayer come over your house. See what I did there?
Yeah, nice segue.
I know, huh? We don't even like Craig, but we give him a lot of airtime on this podcast. But you know
Well,
I'm teasing our listeners. I think no, we're teasing, but Craig paid you a visit a couple of weeks ago.
yeah, he was I guess in town for work and had not been here before, so an invitation was quickly proffered, and so Craig got to step into the Way Forward machine and see the future of railroading, because it's in a little inside joke, because Craig models a couple centuries ago, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so I often wonder, when he looks at a modern, by comparison, layout, if you can call 1985 modern, if it just kind of blows his mind, or if he can even relate to it, because he's so locked into that era that he models. But I think he enjoyed the look-see, and I had stressed that this was in no way a should it should, no way should it represent what the layout will look like. A, when visitors are expected, and B, when we're ready to actually operate on it. Always have that disclaimer, because like anybody who's building a layout, that when you're working on it, it's by no means user friendly. There's stuff everywhere, and it's almost a hazard to be there.
Well, I would suggest that Craig probably appreciated it a great deal. Craig is a very talented modeler, and actually the era that he models, the 1890s, is perfectly suited for both his abilities and his personality, because he
Because he has to
loves to,
make everything.
yeah, he loves to scratch build.
Right.
He, you know, and you know, talk about an era that there really isn't a whole lot available commercially.
Maybe that's what drew him to it.
Yeah, well, it could be. It could be.
I'm sure he told me many moons ago what drew him to it, but I'll be damned if I can remember.
well, and you know, if you've ever seen pictures of the layout, it's just fantastic. And his, it's you know, probably what by today's standards would be called proto freelancing, but there's he takes so much time in consideration of what looks right and what works in that time frame, with you know, not a lot to go by in terms of the ability to research, Mike. You know, we can you can go to Pennsylvania when you want. I can go to Vermont when I want. And really time has stood still in both of those places to a large degree, but to try to turn the clocks back to 1890 and get information becomes a lot more difficult.
On the other hand, you're not likely to be second-guessed by anybody.
No, but you know, Craig's the kind of guy that's going to want to get it right too.
Yeah, he'd be more likely to second-guess himself. I know he puts a lot into getting it right.
Yep.
And I think that kind of research is also part of what's fun for him.
Sure, as it is for you and I. You know, I love the history of the railroads that I model and you know, their antecedents and how it all kind of fell into place. And you know, certainly, you know, the railroad that you're modeling is would never have existed had it not been for you know, the Lehigh Valley and you know, all of that what came before it. So
Right. I've enjoyed learning more about that whole area, and I also like the fact that there are not many model railroads that are focused on the particular section of the line that I'm modeling. You know, it's kind of shining some light on it in a way that it would not maybe otherwise have gotten.
sure. And I guess, you know, what interests me about what you're doing in terms of the prototype is that, you know, if you go 15 miles in either direction, you know, you're going to hit a railroad that everybody on the planet, for the most part, has, you know, modeled or certainly knows about.
Sure.
You know, so you kind of took a road less traveled.
And
And
it's funny because I discovered the entire area quite by accident, just kind of rambling around in Pennsylvania, just seeing what I could find.
well, you told me you fell out of a plane.
Well, that was another time.
Oh, okay. All right. Not to scare anybody. He didn't really fall out of a plane, just in case you think I'm serious.
Would explain a lot, but no, that didn't happen.
You may have coined a new term, Michael,
Oh?
and I'm certainly going to give you credit for it, and I'll let you explain. But what exactly is cooperative modeling?
Oh yeah, I think I
Yep.
did just coin that term.
Yeah.
Cooperative modeling. Well, you know, on one end of the spectrum, there are people who are, you know, very, very busy, lacking in the interest or ability to build a model railroad, and they contract out with a custom layout builder to build their layout. They just want to get it up and running and operate it. On the other end of the spectrum are those who consider their model railroad the ultimate artistic vision expression, and they want 100% of what's on the layout to be something that they did. I used to be one of those guys, actually, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't based on you know any snob attitude or anything. It was just because I enjoyed every aspect of model railroading, and I really wanted it to be my personal vision. And if you enjoyed making the railroad, why would you want to farm any of it out to anybody else? Fast forward. I discovered at one point that I wasn't getting any younger, and I also greatly expanded the scope of my railroad, so it was physically much, much larger than the original concept for it. And also, I had gotten my layout to a point where I was starting to see needs that I hadn't even foreseen in the earlier stages of building the layout. For example, I needed quite a few houses. Now, I enjoy building structures, Do I have any urge to build individual private homes? Really, I don't. The structures that I enjoy building tend to be line-side things, grain elevators and manufacturing plants and freight houses and you name it. If it's connected to the railroad in some way, I'm enjoying the building of that structure. But there's all kinds of other things, gas stations and like I said, in private homes and things that are part of the whole landscape that you as a structure guy would probably take equal pleasure in building, but not me. I just kind of wanted them, but didn't want to. I never would have gotten around to building them. If it were left up to me, I probably wouldn't have a single private home on the layout yet.
Can I just interrupt you for a second and say, just answer your comment. In my case, the answer is no. I don't think I would get much enjoyment out of modeling. I'll call it modeling the mundane.
Interesting. So it's not so much the so the so the subject matter of the structure building is also important to you.
Sure. Absolutely.
So anyway, I discovered through the guys I discovered pretty quickly that everybody was using structure builder Rich Cobb for this purpose. And as I'm admiring some of the structures on their layouts, it's, oh yeah, Rich Cobb built that one. Rich Cobb built that one. Eventually, I started to think, I gotta join the Rich Cobb Built It Club here because I was getting into some neighborhoods where I needed to really flesh them out and make them look like the prototype neighborhood. And I forget which structures that I had Rich build for me first, but there are whole towns on my layout that he's built every house in it. And the reason there's a town there is because Rich built them for me, and he built them well, and he built them at a very, very fair price. And I think he's a big reason why a lot of us have the layouts we do, because him doing that for us has freed us up to do other things that really needed to be done. So, he's one of those, I think, important guys in the hobby for that reason alone.
Well, and it's funny that you're talking about Rich Cobb. Now, he's a guy that's been doing this for several years, and I know he's done a lot of work for you. He's also done quite a bit of work for Dick Elwell, and I want to say that he
Jim
built.
Dufour, Mike Confalone.
Sure, and he I want to say that he built just about every structure on Lou Sassy's old layout before Lou moved from upstate New York to North Carolina.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he's done some really, really important work on some high profile model railroads.
Well, he's been a resource.
Yep.
And in modern times, I mean, that I enjoy painting and lettering locomotives, for example. I've done, I don't know, I'll bet I've done over 100 of them at this point. It's something I always enjoyed. But again, when you're trying to do lots of things and not take forever to get all of it done, at some point, you have to say, there's so many things that I want done that I'd need a couple more lifetimes to do it if I were doing it all myself. So right now I am having two SW1s painted for two different short lines that are going to be interchanging with my layout. And they're being done by my friend Bob Harp down in Savannah, Georgia. I've done many cooperative projects with Bob for customers, but this is literally the first time I've hired somebody to paint a couple of locomotives for me. And what's going to happen is Bob's going to do them. He's going to do a great job on them. They're going to arrive on time for my first op session. I have no doubt about that. And if I hadn't had Bob do these, there's no way that would have been the case, because I'm too busy wrapping up the 50,000 other loose ends that I have here. Another example would be I've got it's too bad they didn't make it in for this show, but I'll certainly be talking about it on the next. My friend Blair Davies in New York is a very accomplished vehicle modeler. He just finds that these company trucks to be of great interest, and he's very good at making these things.
Yeah,
So
he is.
he's sent me I think it's four trucks that he did for me. One of them is a transport bus, a couple one of them is like an X Penn Central with Conrail logos on the side of it, big pickup truck with toolboxes on the side, and a couple of other trucks. So I cannot wait to get these. I have always admired his modeling work, and he and I, in this case, I don't think it's going to be a so much of a cash transaction as a trade for services. So I will no doubt end up doing some sound install work for him by way of compensation. So he thought that might be an interesting topic to bring up, and I fully agreed, because this kind of we're all in this together approach, I think, yields a whole that's bigger than the sum of its parts, if you will. And it's kind of cool to have some of your stuff on somebody else's layout, and it's cool for that person to have something that somebody else did that they've always admired. And when I put those trucks on the layout as part of a scene, I can look at that and think, who knows when and if I ever would have gotten around to doing even one of those, and here's four of them, that will come in and make an immediate heavy impact
Well, and
on the scene.
it's nice to I just want to make 2 points. It's nice to be able to find modelers whose skill levels match your own.
Yeah, compatible modeling skills, exactly.
Right. This has been kind of a neat podcast because, you're talking about people, Russ Green earlier and now, Blair and his brother Dave Davies, just, two people that I've known for a long, long time. Really, really nice guys, great modelers,
Yep. Good, good,
the
good dinner companions.
Penn Central modelers, and just one of the things I miss about the fact that I don't do a lot of shows or hardly any shows anymore, running into these guys, because
Right.
Blair and Dave I would see everywhere. It didn't matter what proto
Oh
meet I
yeah,
was
you'd see him
at.
in Cocoa Beach, you'd see him at Collinsville.
They were, attendees at the Craftsman Structure Show, I
Yep.
think, just about every year. And these are guys that are going to do high quality work for you every opportunity they get.
Two other examples come to mind. I've been known as a weathering guy, and yet sometimes it's nice if you admire somebody else's efforts to get somebody else's work on your layout, because it might have a little different look and
Sure.
feel.
Yeah.
Neil Schofield, perfect example of that. I'm going to be having Neil weather up a couple of like a B&M and a Maine Central locomotive for me, and Neil's work is just killer. You know what I mean? So I'm really looking forward to having his work on my layout as well. I think he's done a couple of other things for me too. I can think of at least one Conrail caboose that he did for me. And there's another friend of mine, Ken Kylerowitz, who lives in New York. He's a D&H modeler. He's kind of getting into the hobby later in life. Ken's a little bit younger than me, but I think he really wanted to get going on his layout. So he hired a guy who's an accomplished builder, and they basically built his base layout together. The carpentry, the track laying, and all of that, and what Ken ended up with is a cooperative effort. So it's got his ideas and concepts. He worked right along with Don to create the layout. Ken's done a lot of the scenery and weathering, and he's got a great eye for all of that. But by working cooperatively with someone to do that, he was able to hit the gas pedal there and get himself what's going to be, I think, an outstanding layout in a fraction of the time it would have taken him to just do it all on his own. I think he correctly felt like to get where he wanted to be, he needed a little bit of an accelerant there. So I guess the reason I bring all of these examples up is that, even if you take pride in everything you do and you want it to be your own personal expression, if you're open to the idea of using compatible cooperative modeling partners to get you over humps or to get things done that you never would have gotten around to, or to get a little bit different flavor to your layout, there's lots of advantages to it, but I guess my point is there's no shame in it, and there's a lot of advantages to it. So I would encourage people that I might be inclined to do that to get the right people involved and go for it, because I think the benefits are real.
As I do too. Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. You have to pick your battles.
Right.
And if you're building a medium to large size model railroad, unless you start at like 8 years old,
Right.
it ain't gonna be finished. And especially the way you're going about
Despite what they say, size matters. And
it.
the bigger the layout, I think, like when I was building Pittston Yard, I was maybe, I don't know, less than halfway through it, and I was feeling how much my back was hurting, and I thought, this is a lot of track to lay in a short period of time. It's a beast of a yard, but I really like the flow of it, and I think it's going to be a fun place to operate. But it was a lot more work to do Pittston Yard than it was to do, say, Towanda, which is much smaller.
Sure. Well, obviously, we will look forward to the updates. Folks, we would very much like it if you bought stuff from us. Is that subtle enough, Mike?
No, I think you should really say what you think on this.
and you can check out my website, www.scottymason.com. And Mike, I'll let you say your piece and your website.
Sure. Well, it's mrhobby.com, and for those that are interested in the sound install end of it, I had gotten such a backlog that it was keeping me up at night. So I took about a week and a half and just went crazy and did the largest number of sound installs in that period that I'd ever done. Just amazing productivity. And had largely cleared up the backlog, with the exception of my friend Chad's steam engine from hell. And Chad knows that when he ultimately gets that, there's not going to be a bill on that. That's the only saving grace I can think of for taking so long on that particular engine. But if you're listening, Chad, you will get it. Hopefully you're not holding your breath. However, when I focused in on trying to get all my electronics debugged and Pittston Yard installed, all of a sudden I turned around and the backlog is creeping right back into double digits again. So, that's a good thing, because it keeps my hand in, it keeps me in touch with the installs, and it is very much a situation where the more of it you do and the more often you do it, the better you get at it, you know what I mean? So that's a good thing. So all I'm saying is keep those cards and letters and locomotives coming in, folks, and the backlog, such as it is now, is not extreme.
Good, good. Keep them busy, folks. That's about it for this month, Mike. I think
Well,
we shot a hole in that one.
and we gave some teasers about what will happen next time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Folks, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next month.
Take care, folks.